Good evening, everyone. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the New York Society Library. Welcome to the library's members' room. It's wonderful to see a lot of familiar faces here tonight, our library members, but it's also very great to see so many guests and people from other parts of the world here tonight for a very special evening. We have an esteemed panel for you this evening, Gail Fox, Jay Perini, and Martin Stannard. For those of you who are in our members' room for the first time, let me just take one moment and tell you that you're visiting the oldest cultural institution in New York. That's not my quote. That's actually the phrase of Christopher Gray, a writer for the New York Times. We are also the oldest library in New York City and one of the most thriving places in New York City. We go back to 1754, and that year we had a collection of roughly 800 books. Today we have over 300,000 books and buy over 4,800 a year. We are now in our fifth home here at 79th and Madison. We have over 3,000 members, and we pride ourselves in providing quality services to both readers and writers. We host events like this evening's book discussion groups, exhibitions, a children's library, writing groups, technology classes, and much, much more. Tonight, we are here for a special evening. We are celebrating one of the world's most gifted and important authors, Shirley Hazzard. This is a very special occasion for the Society Library, as Ms. Hazzard has been a trustee of our library since 1974. She's a good friend and colleague of many of us in the room. In 2010, we were very proud to present an exhibition, Literary Lives, the World of Frances Stiegmuller and Shirley Hazzard, in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery outside. And it was curated by our head of exhibitions, Harriet Shapiro. We are really happy tonight that Shirley Hazzard is able to be with us, so please do give a warm welcome to Shirley Hazzard, who's in our front row. This year, Cambria Press of New York State is proud to publish the first ever book-length study on Shirley Hazzard, and the author of the book is with us tonight, Dr. Brigida Olibus of the University of New South Wales, and she's the author of this important new volume, Shirley Hazzard, Literary Expatriate and Cosmopolitan Humanist. I want to take a quick moment and just say that the role of scholarly publications like this new book is critical to the world of learning and critical to society. It's important that publications of great writers like Ms. Hazzard can be read by many, but it's also just as important that the works be interpreted, discussed, and debated. We are so pleased to be the site for the American book launch of this important publication, and congratulations to our friend Brigida, and the association that we've had with you the last couple of years has been really wonderful. Glad you could be here. It's now my honor to finish by welcoming a very special guest, Mr. Philip Scanlon, the Australian Consul General here in New York. Mr. Scanlon's career spans enterprise education, public policy, NGO entrepreneurship, and diplomacy. He has more than 25 years of global experience in chief, senior executive, and chairman's roles. In 1992, he founded the bipartisan Australian-American Leadership Dialogue, described publicly as the most significant exercise in private diplomacy to come out of Australia. He is a fellow of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, a long-standing member of the YPO-WPO Global Enterprise Network, and he's served on the Business Council of Australia and on the board of AsiaLink. He's also served on the Fulbright Board and was inaugural chairman of the Sydney Institute, Australia's premier current affairs forum. As Consul General here in New York, he has continued to strengthen the platform of engagement assembled by his predecessors through a range of initiatives. Mr. Scanlon is a graduate from Sydney University, and he holds master's degrees from Oxford and Harvard's JFK School of Government. So please welcome Philip Scanlon.
Thank you very much indeed, Mark. And I've had the pleasure of conversation with a number of your esteemed members, all of whom tell me how lucky the library is to have you. So congratulations on the work you're doing. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a real privilege and pleasure for me to be here in the official capacity on behalf of the Australian Government to celebrate one of our national treasures and a literary treasure of the globe in this national and New York City cultural treasure. It goes back to 1754. It's a delight for me to welcome Shirley, who I had a chat with earlier tonight, because in October 2009, we hosted Shirley at the Australian Consulate General for the launching of an anthology of Australian literature, after which Shirley adorned 19 others around our table of dinner at our residence, and it was an unforgettable evening. And Shirley, it's such a privilege and a wonder for me to be here in your presence again this evening. She is unquestionably one of our most respected writers on loan to New York for a long time. She has written in what I will venture to say a distinctively Australian tone. In this city in 1960, while she was surviving the ranks of the United Nations, she almost absent-mindedly set off her first story to the New Yorker, where it was accepted and published. And so began her adoption by New Yorkers who live in this busy city but do not live with bluster. Perhaps it was her perspective on New York, gained from the bottom of the globe and clarified by all the travel she'd done by her mid-20s, which enabled Shirley to discover and then write about truths that were not always acceptable to voice in her own time. Being Australian is about bringing a voice that's quietly confident. It's also about having an ear that is keen for dialogue. With these qualities, Shirley Hazzard is and has been for a long time one of Australia's finest ambassadors. Now, I particularly want to honour tonight Shirley's willingness to speak out about the position of women at the United Nations and in its member countries during her own time. And that's something that you talked a lot about, Shirley, in October 09 and over dinner. Just last week, the Executive Director of UN Women, Michelle Bachelet, who you will all know in her former presidential role, visited our national capital of Canberra, and she met with Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard, praising Australia's commitment to empowering women leaders. And as the father of five daughters and two sons, I just like to say personally, I think this is one of the big global issues of today. And I feel very strongly about that. And I'm delighted with the fact that our Governor General and our Prime Minister are both women, long before time, don't quote that, long before time. And I'm so proud of the fact that Michelle Bachelet was there last week. Now, this evening's panel promises to be a wonderful opportunity to appreciate Shirley's work and impact. Last night, I noticed that a number of people were here tonight, were there last night. We had a wonderful panel that talked about Patrick White, as well as Shirley, The Eye of the Storm, and earlier this week we had the New York premiere of the movie Eye of the Storm by director Fred Shepsey, and with a number of Australia's predominant actors and actresses, Geoffrey Rush, Judy Davis, in concert with their global peers like Charlotte Rampling and so on. People like Meryl Streep and others were there. It was a fantastic night. And this being the 100th or the centenary of Patrick White's birth. I'd also like to wish all the very best to those taking part in the symposium at the Heymann Centre at Columbia over this weekend. And Brigida, congratulations. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in applause for Brigida Olibas and her panel.
It is a great pleasure and a privilege to be here tonight in such company to honour Shelley Hazzard. I would first like to make some further thanks and acknowledgements because an event like this only happens due to the hard work and generosity of many people. First, thank you to the New York Society Library, in particular Mark Bartlett, but also Harriet Shapiro, Sarah Holliday and their team for hosting this evening. Working together with you on this event has been a pleasure in itself and for me a lesson in how to make things work. Also, thank you to the Australian Consul General, Phil Scanlon, for your continued interest in and support of Australian literary culture here in New York. Thanks also to Varad Reinisch, from the Australian Consulate, for all the work you've done on the ground for last night's Patrick White panel and helping make tonight the event that it is. Events like these provide the opportunity for literary scholars like myself and my colleagues to present our work to a wide and clearly very engaged public. And this creates a really significant conversation that we are genuinely excited to be having. Great writers, and in my view, and I share this view with Mark and I'm sure most of you, in my view, Shelley Hazzard, like Patrick White, is a great writer. Great writers have no trouble forging connections with their individual readers, particularly during their writing lives. And there's no doubt that Shelley Hazzard's work produces readers who are passionate, committed, thoughtful, and demanding. These readers are at the heart of any literary reputation. But there is also an important role to be played by academic critics through the kind of sustained, focused, and painstaking work that we're privileged to do, and this extends the public understanding of literature. It is amazing, given Shelley Hazzard's profile, that there had not been a major scholarly study of her work before mine, and I'm proud to have made this first contribution to what I'm confident will be a rich conversation. It is a conversation that, in a way, begins tonight, continues tomorrow, in the scholarly symposium that I'm co-convening with Dr. Nicholas Burns from the New School here in New York, and thank you, Nicholas, for all your work on this. The symposium has been made possible by Akhil Belgrami, who is also here tonight, Johnsonian Professor of Philosophy at Columbia University, admirer of Shelley Hazzard, and I want to thank Akhil here for his generosity in offering the Heymann Centre to us for the symposium. There's also been assistance from the Australian Research Council for my own work on Shelley Hazzard, as well as for these events. And I want to acknowledge the continuing importance of this kind of public funding for academic research and to draw attention to some of the more varied fruits that it yields, events like tonight. I'm also extremely grateful to all the academics speaking tonight and tomorrow for having made their way across the Pacific Ocean, across the Atlantic Ocean, across the continent, from out of town, and from across town to speak to each other and to us all about Shelley Hazzard's work. This is significant in itself. Many, indeed most of us, have dashed out in the middle of a teaching term, and I'm really deeply appreciative of the massive effort that this represents, so thank you all. On the other hand, you get to come to New York, so I feel there's an intrinsic reward in the exercise. On a more personal note, I would also like you to record my great appreciation to Shelley's friend, Frances Alston, who has given such assistance to all of us. I know she doesn't want me to say this, but I'm afraid I am. Truly, none of this would have been possible without you, Frances, so thank you. Finally, it is my great pleasure to introduce another of Shelley Hazzard's great friends, Annabel Davis Goff. Annabel is the author of an acclaimed memoir of Anglo-Irish childhood, Walled Gardens, and of the novels The Dower House, Cold Country and The Fox's Walk. She's Professor of English at Bennington College, another academic who has dashed here mid-term, where she's currently acting as head of department and researching D.H. Lawrence. And Annabel will open the literary part of the evening with a reading from Shirley Hazzard. Thank you, Annabel.
Thank you, Brigitte. I don't quite recognise that description of my modest enough job, but it'll be encouraging to think of it like that. I'm going to read a little bit of Shirley's work, and I want to make sure, can you hear me, Shirley?
I can only just hear you, and I don't want to miss any compliments.
Yes. Just volume up a little bit. Up, yes. All right. May I move this? Thank you, Ben. I'm going to read a part of a scene from A Place in the Country. The story is a favourite of mine. I love the way that Shirley, with her usual wit, precise description of detail, without an extra word, very few adjectives, for instance, tells us everything. I'm sure most of you know this story well, but just to recap the cast of characters. Nettie is spending a weekend in the country with her cousin May and May's husband Clem. Nettie is in love with Clem. Some neighbors, Sarah and Vernon, have been invited to dinner, but May has to go and look after a sick child. We start the excerpt after dinner. When the telephone rang, Clem put his coffee cup and saucer down on the uneven mosaic, where they rocked a little, and went into the hall. They heard him speaking loudly, as people do on a long-distance call, even when the connection is good. "He doesn't sound alarmed," said Nettie. Sarah said, "One never knows with these things." Clem's voice went on with long pauses. Instinctively, they watched the doorway. But it was Marion, not Clem, who first appeared there, startling in a coat and hat. She gave a polite but meaning glance at Nettie, who, with a little gasp of recollection, sprung up from her chair and left the room. In the drawer of the hall table, there was an envelope that May had marked Marion, and this Nettie now passed on stealthily. "I hope it's all right," she said, having little reason to doubt it. Marion, infinitely more assured than Nettie, put the envelope in an immense black handbag. "I'll be over tomorrow," she said, "and I hope Matt's all right." "Yes, thank you. Good night," said Nettie. She closed the front door. Clem, sitting on the stairs with the telephone receiver in his hand, was still talking, but with a terminal inflection. As she passed him, he reached out and touched her dress. "Matt must be better," she thought. When she came back into the living room, Vernon was leaning forward as if he had been speaking earnestly. Sarah, Nettie noted, looked confused. Nettie did not sit down, but started to assemble the empty cups on a tray. "Let me help," Sarah said, taking up the coffee pot. "Don't bother, really. I'll just leave them in the kitchen." Nettie was halfway to the door. "Matt is better," said Clem, appearing in the doorway. "It's a throat infection, apparently." "I knew it," Sarah said. "His temperature is down." "I'm so glad." The coffee pot waggled slightly. "Perhaps I should have spoken to May. What is she planning to do?" "She's going to call me in the morning. It depends how he is. She may stay there a day or two." Nettie took a firmer grip on the tray and walked down the corridor. "Be careful," she said over her shoulder to Sarah, who at once followed her with the coffee pot. There's a step. She pushed open the kitchen door with her elbow. "Can you find the light?" "On the left. Thanks." The light fell, dazzling, on aluminum saucepans and a huge white refrigerator. "Just put it anywhere. I'm not going to wash them tonight." Sarah kept the coffee pot in her hands, but came across the room. "Nettie," she began, with as much solemnity as haste would allow, "we would be so pleased if you would come home with us." Nettie put the tray down carefully by the sink. Taking up the sugar pole, she walked past Sarah and put it away in a cupboard. "Because of the ants," she remarked apologetically. She returned to the sink and started to pour away the dregs from the cup. "I don't understand," she said. Blankly, she felt this to be true. It was her own stillness she did not understand. Sarah came and stood at the sink so that it was impossible not to look at her. She had a flushed, uncomfortable expression, and Nettie noticed that her eyes were not only pretty, but even kind. "No, of course not, but Vernon Fields, people around here gossip so. Unprincipled, really. You shouldn't be exposed to that." Sarah grew impatient before Nettie's empty look. "And of course we'd love to have you." Her voice ran down. "It's really quite easy to have the advantage over people," Nettie thought, "if you can be bothered. You just have to keep quiet and look at them." "I'll have to see what Clem thinks," she said at last. She finished stacking the rinsed dishes and dried her hands. She exchanged a little hopeless glance with Sarah. "You go ahead," she said. "I'll put the light out. Watch the step." In the hall, she stopped to straighten a mirror. She felt that she had unlimited time at her disposal. She could hear voices raised in the living room and for a moment stood still with a child's pleasurable horror in listening to a grown-up quarrel. She stared into the mirror, exasperated, as Sarah had been, by her own unresponsiveness. To see her feelings reflected in her face would have made them clearer to her. But here was, simply, a strained, alarmed expression made them more unfamiliar by the care with which it had that evening been powdered and embellished. As she entered the room, she heard Clem's voice, cold and angry. "I'm afraid I don't understand." "But don't you think?" Sarah's voice wavered anxiously. It was her fate that evening not to be understood. Clem broke in. "Good Lord, she's like a daughter in the house. What an extraordinary idea, perfectly extraordinary. In fact," his voice rose on a short, humorless laugh, "if we didn't know each other so well, I would say it was downright insulting." "Oh dear," Sarah said. Vernon had not said a word. Nettie came further into the room and glanced at Clem. She saw that he had managed to be genuinely angry. Angry in some way with her, too. She felt chilly and walked past him to the fire. There was an arduous silence. The fire flared and crumbled and flared again. Resting her arm on the mantelpiece, Nettie stayed with her back to the room in an attitude of unintended pathos. "Oh, hell," said Clem, concedingly. He laughed more encouragingly and reached into his pocket for cigarettes. "Why are things so complicated?" Sarah asked generally. Nettie looked round at her with compassion. "Let's all sit down and have a brandy," Vernon suggested. "That's a rather better idea," Clem said. "Sarah, never mind, no harm done." She gave a nervous, relieved little laugh. "Oh, Clem, I can't tell you how sorry." "No, Vernon, of course we can't. It's so late. Clem, we must be going." Suddenly active, she discovered her handbag beneath a cushion on the sofa. "Here it is." "Are you really leaving?" asked Clem. He took her arm. They went into the hall. Vernon followed them, but stood back at the door to let Nettie pass. They did not look at one another. Clem was bringing coats and Vernon's hat from the closet. Sarah kissed Nettie again and drew on her gloves. "Be sure to let me know how Matt is." She let Clem kiss her cheek. "I do hope it isn't anything serious. I do hope it isn't anything serious," she said. "Clem, dear, do forgive." "No harm done," he repeated. He smiled with complete goodwill. He almost looked pleased. Vernon took Nettie's hand briefly and released it. He followed Sarah into the garden, and Nettie stood where he had left her, behind the open door. Clem, holding the door handle, watched them go to their car. He called good night and waved once or twice with his free hand. Sarah called out that the grass was wet. A car door, improperly closed, was banged several times before Vernon started the engine. When the sound of the car receded, Clem closed the front door and switched off the outside lights. He linked across the lock a small gilt chain in which May had complete confidence. Now, thought Nettie, he will hesitate and smile. Instead, he turned at once with a grave, concerned voice and took her into his arms. They stayed this way in silence until Nettie drew back and leaned against the door. Clem moved forward slightly, holding her with his left hand and supporting his right on the panel above her head. "Don't shake," he said at last, speaking into her hair. "It isn't complimentary." His left arm tightened. She felt him smile. "In fact, if we didn't know each other so well, I would say it was downright insulting. Thank you."
Hi, everyone. I'm Jonathan Galassi, and I'm just the transition to the speakers. Would you please come up and take your seats? Martin Stannard, Gail Jones, and Jay Perini. Martin is a well-known biographer of Evelyn Waugh and Muriel Spark. Sorry. Gail teaches at the University of Western Sydney as a novelist and also a critic. And Jay is a biographer, novelist, poet. And we're going to hear what they have to say about Shirley.
Who goes first? Right. Well, it's a great honour to be here in this august institution. And it's a great honour to, one I couldn't resist, I must say, to come and pay court to Shirley, whom I've known for 19 years, amazingly. And I'll be talking about this more tomorrow, but I'll just very briefly sketch out how I came to meet her. I was writing a biography of Muriel Spark, and Shirley knew Muriel very well in New York in the early 60s. And I put a little ad in the TLS, and a letter arrived saying that in her good scholarly way, she'd been going through the TLS and had noticed this little ad saying, asking for information about Muriel Spark, and that she had some letters and that she'd known Muriel and so on, and that she lived between New York and Italy. If I would care to drop in on any occasion, she'd be more than happy to talk to me. As it happened, my partner and I, who'll be giving a paper tomorrow, we regularly went to Italy, and we went to stay in Basilicata. So on the 21st of February, 1993, the 21st of September, 1993, we took the train up, and we were met with a car that Shirley had sent to Naples station and driven out to a lovely villa on the peninsula of Posillipo, where we had a delightful lunch. We had our little daughter with us as well. We were a bit nervous about this because we didn't know, you know, how people would react to us carting a four-year-old about on scholarly expeditions, but Shirley immediately warmed to the little girl, who was by this stage, because we'd been up since 5 o'clock in the morning, comatose. So Zudi was put to sleep on the sofa and slept throughout this. Wonderful child. After I was introduced to Francis Stiegmüller, Shirley's husband, of course, and he was equally delightful. To my shame, in those days, I didn't know that Shirley was a huge figure on the New York art scene, or indeed, really, other than by reputation, that Francis was an equally huge scholarly figure. But the first thing I would want to say about Shirley is that she is an intellectual in the best possible sense, but without the slightest hint of intellectual ostentation. And so what happened was that, I think, we immediately became friends. She was so welcoming, so kind, so generous. And it was as though I were talking to somebody that I'd known for years. We were exchanging all sorts of information that you usually don't exchange with people until you have known them for years. And she gave me an immediately vivid picture of what she described in her first letter to me as the many Muriels, you know, this kind of extraordinary figure who could change so quickly and who inhabited many different kinds of life. One of the difficulties of writing the Spark biography was that, in a way, I was writing about eight biographies because she walked out of one life, closed the door on it, and then started the new one. And I think, in a sense, Shirley experienced that a bit. She picked up on Muriel when Muriel was surfing a tidal wave of fame after the publication of the Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which, of course, became a huge success. The New Yorker published it as almost an entire issue. I think the first British novelist, or certainly the first British female novelist ever to have that accolade. She was at work, I think, on The Girls of Slender Means and on Mandelbaum Gate. And Shirley, I think, at that time was a tyro writer. She'd just had her first stories accepted by The New Yorker. And they became great friends very quickly and spent a lot of time together. So Shirley's evidence was extremely useful to me, a real fly-on-the-wall account. In fact, I think Shirley's correspondence with Muriel was the last in which Muriel ever revealed things about herself to anybody else. So it says a lot for Shirley that Muriel felt that warmly towards her. So we had this first meeting, and then I met her again in New York the following February, when I had the privilege of visiting her in her apartment with Francis's amazing collection of paintings. I couldn't quite believe it, you know. So looking around the room, rather hopelessly trying to make conversation about these canvases and saying things like, "That looks like a Breck." And Francis would say, "It is a Breck." but again, a very, very happy and productive time. One of the things I think, I'll finish with this, I mean, that immediately struck one, that was that Shirley was... Not just an intellectual in the best sense of the word, and obviously, you know, a great creative artist, but she was a wonderful human being. I mean, I was, you know, a nobody, but she didn't treat me like that. She treated me with great respect and treated Sharon with great respect. And the remarks that were made earlier about Shirley's concern about women's rights were immediately apparent. Sharon, my partner, had just published a book on women writers of the First World War. And Shirley went out of her way. I've got a letter at home, you know, where she sent, you know, she went off researching. She knew she could remember a poem by a woman poet in the First World War. Couldn't put her hand on it, but researched it, found it, copied it out, sent it. It's that kind of thing, attention to detail, but also warmth and generosity. The only thing I ever heard her, or the only person in, or institution I ever heard her speak ill of, was the United Nations. I couldn't quite work out what all that was about, but maybe that's just my ignorance, of course, at the time. But obviously women's issues were very important to that as well. So I would just like to say congratulations on a brilliant life's career. We're all very privileged to have known you. Thank you.
I have to join the panel in expressing deep gratitude for the opportunity to honour Shirley Hazzard. Okay. I'm very, very privileged to be here to honour Shirley. I'm speaking tonight as a novelist and as an academic and as the only Australian on the panel. And I'd like to talk about Shirley's style, because it seems to me that one way to honour her is to consider the beauty of her work, its exceptional qualities. And I've been thinking about her style for some time now, and recently I realised that circulating in the back of my head was an aphorism from Jean-Paul Sartre, which goes, "A writer's style is his metaphysics." And this seems to me to say that within a style is embedded ineluctable relations of inner and outer and space and time, of the constitution of subjectivity or consciousness, of social relations, and because it's Sartre, also a kind of existential site in relation to things like power, agency, history, and so on. So I thought I would just talk about the metaphysics of Shirley Hazzard's style, such as I believe it to be, because it seems to me that there are many admirers of the text, the textuality, the dense and perfectionist textuality of her work, and that those of us who admire her work, and we are legion, often admire the sort of imagistic exorbitance, the quality of audacity, of ingenuity, of bold excursiveness that exists within Shirley's work. So this is something I think that she shares with Patrick White. I'd like to think it's a kind of native Australian writerly quality, but alas, it's not. Only a few of the very gifted have this quality, I think. But often this linguistic felicity and originality that we see as distinctive in Shirley's work comes accompanied with a kind of wry, oblique social critique, and it's that combination that particularly interests me. We know that she's sassy and wise and clever and in all of these things, but there is also this wry quality that's worth investigating as a kind of metaphysical quality, I think. So what I've done is choose two pieces of writing which I'd like to read, not in a professional way, in order then to just say a little bit about how I think they're working. So there is this very extravagant, sometimes showy, fabulous quality to the writing, but there's also another kind of writing which is reticent, which works by, I think, withholding, by a kind of quiet, abstracted quality, almost a quality of rarefaction, I think. And so the first piece I want to read to you is of that quality, is one of these quiet pieces. This is an extract from The Evening of the Holiday. It's a scene where, if you know the novel, where Sophie and Tancredi have gone for a walk to a fountain. Sophie has reached into the fountain and the bracelet has slipped from her arm and she has to retrieve it. I'll just read two paragraphs. She leaned on the whitened outer curve of the fountain, smiling a little dazzled by the hot sun. She unbuttoned her right cuff and rolled up her sleeve. When her arm was bare above the elbow, she bent over the marble rim and, placing her hand through the water, brought out the bracelet. He thought, as he'd watched her, that in all his life he'd never seen a more seductive thing than this unconsidered gesture with which she folded back her sleeve. He saw the brown outer skin of her arm as she turned her wrist, the surprising, vulnerable white of the inward flesh, and the veined curve inside the elbow. Her reaching hand and forearm, momentarily transfigured by water, had seemed in that instant to form part of the design attributed to Pisano, but probably even older. These simple actions moved him by their involuntary power, their immense accomplishment. He was amazed, too, by the magnitude of his own response, which gave her gesture real consequence. Although he had spoken to her earlier of his romantic temperament, he was shaken by this pang of authentic sentiment, as if he had encountered a friend totally unchanged after an absence of 20 years. Now, there seemed to me many things worth saying about that. But first, there is the extraordinary rhythmical beauty of the prose, the specificity of the moment of erotic interception. It's not an expected moment. It's not a sort of set-up romance. It's a moment of unanticipated erotic interception that relies so much on the specificity, on the particularity of that lavish glimpse of the white arm. It's like a Jamesian gaze. It's very ardent. It's very fulsome. It's very sexy, I think, in its sort of withholding. The second thing, which is much more to do with metaphysics, I think, is to do with time. So what happens in Shirley's work is that often there's the sort of glamour of classicism operating, which I think gives a frame to her style. So that the invocation of a classical time with the reference to Pisano and the fountain, this somehow sets up a kind of layering of temporal orders that has to collapse in order for real feeling to begin. And this seems to me so typical of the way Shirley works, that there is this layering and this collapse before the commencement. And those words like magnitude, this is something of enormous magnitude that's happening before that can actually happen. And the third thing I think that is distinctive in this section is to do with vision and optics. So that gesture of the hand moving into the water is straight out of Seneca. It's classical optics. He uses that example to talk about the transfiguring quality of vision. And so when the hand goes into the water, we get this collapse of space and time. We get the mystery of her writing, this sort of extraordinary capacity that Shirley has to mesh times together, to loop back into the classical and to reinvest what could be a kind of corny moment with a sort of beautiful lyrical stasis, with a kind of completion, the kind of Keatsian plenitude. The second piece I want to read you is also short, but I thought I should read something that refers to Australia, since I'm the Australian on the panel, and also since that wry quality I think is most evident when she's talking about Australia. This is a piece in a very different register. It's from The Transit of Venus. Again, I'd just like to read you two paragraphs, and I do apologise for the sort of teacherly mode here, but I felt it was important to address what is so lovely, what is so ensorcelling about Shirley Hazzard's work. Going to Europe, someone had written, was about as final as going to heaven. A mystical passage to another life from which no one returned the same. Those returning in such ships were invincible, for they had managed it and could reflect ever after on Anne Hathaway's cottage or the Tower of London with a confidence that did not generate in Sydney. There was nothing mythic at Sydney. Momentous objects, beings, all events occurred abroad or in the elsewhere of books. Sydney could never take for granted, as did the meanest town in Europe, that a poet might be born there or a great painter walk beneath its windows. The likelihood did not arise. They did not feel they deserved it. There was the measure of resentful obscurity. They could not imagine a person who might expose or exalt it. There was the harbour, and the open sea, in an atmosphere in which a sunset might be comfortably admired, but not much else. Any more private joy, in light or dark, in leaf or gatepost, savoured of revelation and was uncountenanced, even in wisteria or wattle, on mornings newer, surely, than anywhere else could now achieve. There was a stillness on certain evenings, or a cast to rocks, or a design of languid branch against a sky that might be announcing glory. Though it could hardly be right to relish where Dora was aggrieved, the girls put their smooth faces to gardenias, inhaling December for a lifetime. Dora, of course, is the monstrously comic figure of The Transit of Venus, and we haven't talked about the comic. But this is an unusual piece because Australia is in a sort of craven state of post-colonial depredation. It's in perpetual cultural deficit. It's erased, it's nullified, it's nullifying of ambition and of literary nullifying of aesthetics, of aesthetic ambition. So we have a sort of spoiled spectacle, a churlish tone, a kind of sense of disappointment. And yet, what is fascinating about this piece for me is that even as it is disconfirming the place, it is providing us with a kind of reclamation or an affirmation. So that the fascinating thing is that I think that for me, Shirley Hazzard is enormously interested in the persistence of sensual pleasure, and in the way in which there are things that, despite the calamities of history, that persist as a form of joy that come from childhood. So the two girls pressing their faces into the December scent, you know, the hyperbolic Sydney December, the very scented December, they are, again, it's about time. They're inhaling time as well as place. There's a wonderful collapse of systems of meaning in the way that she operates here. I think it's a brilliant gesture, a very surprising gesture. And the last thing I'd like to say, because I think my 5 minutes are up, is that thinking again about Sartre, I mean, I don't know whether that quote came from Saint-Genest, his book on Genet, or from the book on Sartre. The book on Flaubert, An Idiot in the Family. But thinking about that book, Sartre argues that Flaubert has a very exasperated tone talking about his own people, because he must both register cultural detail as faithfully as possible, but he also is obliged to critique cultural idiocy and the pressure to conform. And this leads, according to Sartre, to a kind of torsion within the prose which sets up a contradiction. And I often think that this is also operating in Shirley's work, and it feels very presumptuous saying it in front of her. But to me, there's something very interesting about the way in which Sartre has described this making and unmaking process in Flaubert as one of cultural ambivalence. And it's the reason, I think, why Italy is more important for Shirley Hazzard than Australia, why time is more important than place, and why you might have a kind of beautiful moment of romantic completion alongside a coruscating piece of social satire. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Let me see if this is working. It is. I'm delighted. Thank you, Gail, and thank you, Martin. I'm honored to be here tonight to celebrate Shirley Hazzard and her remarkable achievement over so many decades. She's true. These things happen. You know, I sat down the other day and I wrote this rather academic and tedious spiel, which I'm going to just ignore, because I think that would be more sensible, listening to these lovely extempore comments. And I'll just speak for 5 minutes. I think better to speak from the heart, because I feel very passionately about the work of Shirley Hazzard. I think she is a truly great world novelist. I was just last week looking at the New York Times bestseller list, and you see the novels listed, and I always love the one-sentence descriptions of the novels. And, you know, you see over and over again, they're either, you know, people chasing each other around and killing each other, these tedious third-rate thrillers, or tedious fantasies of one kind or another, or the more literary works where they're described as, over and over again, the one phrase description will be trouble in a Midwestern family. And one would never see a novel by Shirley Hazard which could be described as trouble in a Midwestern family. And that's such a relief in that, you know, just for a start. Not that I don't feel sorry for all those poor people in the Midwest. But in many ways, I think what a novelist's job is, on some level, is the imagination of reality. And that includes a kind of the imagination of history, especially in our own time. We can't even see history without the wonderful mirror of fiction. And Shirley has brilliantly held up this mirror in her stories, Cliffs of Fall and so forth, in Bay of Noon, Transit of Venus, The Great Fire. These are treasures of literature written in English. They're treasures of world fiction. And in these works, she has actually done something that very few novelists in the post-war era have done. Essentially, taken a global view of reality and mediated this global view, often through an incredibly intelligent narrator or character. I mean, when you think of Jenny in The Bay of Noon, you think of the Bell sisters in Transit of Venus, you think of that marvelous Helen and Leith in The Great Fire. These are superbly intelligent creatures. And never for one second, not only does Shirley Hazard never talk down to her reader, she lifts us up in the most spectacular way. My favorite of her books really is, although I love them all, is probably The Great Fire. And partly because I was on the National Book Award Committee that chose it for the award 2003. And I was a passionate supporter of that novel. I remember coming into the meeting saying, we've been all sent 400 novels, and there's only one novel in the whole batch. Created quite a gasp. But I passionately defended this, and to my amazement, everybody said, oh, you're right. And we unanimously agreed that Shirley Hazard's The Great Fire was not only the work deserving of the National Book Award that year, but we all agreed we were very lucky to be in the presence of a great novelist who had delivered a masterwork. I mean, how often does that happen? I've actually reread it many times, and only last week in preparation for this, on my long walks in the country near my house in Vermont, I never listened to the tape of it before, and I recommend it heartily. I've read it 3 or 4 times, but I listened to it last week. I don't know who reads it, but whoever does, it's a splendid reading of that work. And you realize, you sense both the fragile quality of the prose, the kind of gossamer-like brilliance of the prose. Nevertheless, it's hard edges. And Shirley has a brilliant sense of reality. And again and again, she never shies away from the difficulties of life. You know, that book begins with, within 24 hours, poor Major Leith experiences not one but two violent deaths. So, and of course, always in the backdrop is the ferocious post-world, Holocaust era feeling of Hiroshima and the disaster there. And how she describes, I know that she herself traveled into Japan in 1947 and so witnessed that astonishing post-atom bomb sensation and post-defeat sense of Japan. And the way she describes the kind of fragile, luminous hills in the distance of the harbor, and she talks about the way she describes those trees broken along the horizon, the skeletons of trees. Caricature to say that she writes poetic prose. It's only poetic in the most in the sense that there's such a delicate evocation of reality in this prose, and on every single page one is brought breathlessly back to a sense of reality and the complexities of human life. And in these novels as a whole, in the stories, think of the sweep. Think of her background and how she pulls it into the work, the Bell sisters, going from Australia, from Sydney, to London, to New York, so brilliantly evinced, to Stockholm. What's that?
First to the Far East.
Everything. The Far East is it. The whole, I mean, how many novelists today, would dare or could possibly hope to manage the entire world in a novel, you know? And she has done this over and over again, kind of with breathless ease, managed to light everywhere in the world and to sew it together and to show us human relationships always. It's always so particularized, too. She can. What I love about Hazard's work is the way she can make a generalization about the English or the Americans or the Australians, and she's willing to do this, and she's willing to make huge generalizations about love and this sort of thing. I mean, I'd written a bunch of them down. I just love some of the generalizations, but it sounds like a bad thing to say generalizations, but I do not mean it that way, because... She writes, for instance, in Transit of Venus, although the dissolution of love creates no heroes, the process itself requires heroism. That's the kind of thing. I mean, astonishing truths which just keep coming at us, and yet the particulars of human experience. Another phrase I just drew from Transit: pain rose up from her thorax and descended like sheets behind her eyes. It's that kind of particularization. I mean, we've all felt pain on that level and understood those sheets falling behind our eyes. And I just feel like when I read Shirley's work, again and again, I feel like I'm brought into the presence of reality. It's mediated through her brilliance and of her imagination and her language. But I feel like, you know, she's making holes over and over again, taking disparate experiences and shaping them and making new holes. So this is the greatest gift that a writer can give to a reader, a sense of reality mediated through language, which is, you know, she summons a vision again and again and declares it pure. And that's what's happening in these great novels. I love, especially having spent 30 years ago, I met Shirley when I was living in Naples myself and in Capri. And I just think she's done such wonders with Naples in her work. You can't even begin to describe. I love what she says in one of her books. She writes of Naples: "The question is, what is it? Took on here an aspect of impertinence. One might only learn what it had successively been." And she does this kind of thing again and again. She takes us through the piazzas of Naples into the grand salone. She takes us into the alleyways. She takes us, but into the characters, especially foreign characters coming in and meeting Italian characters, and the endless confrontation of various cultural entities in her work somehow generates a sense of fullness and a feeling that the world is somehow in your palm, and that for a brief passing moment, you feel like you have understood something. And rarely does that experience happen to readers, and so it's with huge gratitude that I say, congratulations, Shirley. You're one of the greats.
Well, those were all wonderful presentations, and I think we should ask our panelists to continue. And I thought I would just try to start them off by saying this, that it seems to me that I love, one of my favorite books of Shirley's is The Bay of Noon, and it's to me the primal text of the new world meeting the old world, and coming to, it's a Jamesian theme in a way, but Jenny meets these very amazingly exciting, alluring, fallen people, and it's their fallenness that really is what gives them dimension and what she needs to fall with them in a way. And so I'd like to ask you all if what you think about the confrontation of the new and the old worlds in her work.
Could I I'll just talk a little bit about This isn't so much about, well, it is about Shirley. It is about Shirley's work, but it's also about a very interesting conversation that we had when we first met. And when we were just getting, you know, to know each other and over lunch, Francis talked about the hideous mugging that he had endured in Naples, and very kindly, when we were leaving, gave us a copy of his privately printed and previously New Yorker article called The Incident at Naples, which is, I have to say, also an amazing piece of writing. It is a truly brilliant essay. And when that discussion was going on and we were talking about Naples, and we were also loved southern Italy, obviously hadn't had the experience that Shirley had had, but we've carried on going back there for the subsequent 19 years. An incident that had happened to Sharon came into play, where she had been in a taxi in Naples, log-jammed in football traffic, and the taxi driver, trying to do his best to get her to the airport, had driven up some byways and got stuck, at which point he lit a cigarette. And although I was a smoker for years and Sharon put up with it, she's not someone to sit in a cab with somebody smoking in the front. So she wound down the window. And one of the famous snatchers came up on a motorbike, put his hand through the window, snatched her satchel. And with it went her tickets, her passport, and all her money. And the point about the story was that the taxi driver, who up to that point had been a kind of streetwise thug, suddenly transformed into a citizen and took it upon him to drive her to the police station where she could make her statement and get a typed and signed statement as to what had happened. Then drove her to the airport. She had no money. This is all a matter of some hours. Went into the airport with her, explained to the people in the airport what had happened, with the result that she was able to board her plane with no identification whatsoever and get home safely. Now, the point about the anecdote was that the mugging itself, if you can call it that, was something which might make you hate the place. And it is a dangerous city. You feel the danger as soon as you come into the centre of it. And you're walking through Piazza Garibaldi, you feel you have your life in your hands, and certainly you have to have your money in your hands, that's for sure. The point about the anecdote was this dual nature of the Neapolitan. And this is what I think fascinated Francis and Shirley in their, and Francis in his essay. And I think, I mean, this is a long way round of saying, I think the chances are that unless you know something about Naples, you're never going to really find out what makes Shirley tick. I think Naples is right at the heart of the whole thing, and it's very interesting. You know, she moves, has moved her life backwards and forwards between Naples or Capri and New York, and I imagine they're quite different kinds of lives, of course, but they are two halves, as it were, of her cultural mind, which gives the writing this immense kind of Jamesian richness. And I think it's quite right to say that it's often about, you know, the the coming together of the new world and the old. Jamesian is a word that often springs to my mind. I think Shirley is a latter-day representative of that kind of serious writing, which is rich with psychological perspectives and unanswered questions, as well as the wonderfully kind of astute observations which seem to sum everything up in a sentence. But I just thought I'd mention Naples.
Well, I don't have personal anecdotes of knowing Shirley because I hadn't met her before, so I only know Shirley through her writing. But I cannot think about Naples without thinking about Pompeii. And it seems to me that it's the radical proximity of death, catastrophe, the sort of monumentalism, the degraded, moving monumentalism of Pompeii that enters the work on Naples for me. I mean, if you remember the novel, the Bay of Noon opens with a plane crash. It opens with a sort of displaced death. And there's something about, I mean, I'm very charmed by Naples. I find it a very beautiful city. But I went to Naples in order to go to Pompeii and to get a sense of what it might mean to live in adjacency to calamity, to the constant reminder of world historical calamity. And there's a scene in the novel in Tuscany, the evening of the holiday, in which a lot of urns are smashed in a storm. I don't know if you remember this. So the it's about antiquity under and the old world actually not entirely preserved and safe, but always under threat or by inclemencies of different kinds. In the Bay of Noon, there is there's also an interest in the sort of Jenny goes to flea markets and picks up random objects which seem to her to crack open time, to bring the past back to her. And I cannot help but think of Antonioni, the movie L'Avventura, because, of course, that novel is also about Italian neorealist cinema. And there's what I think is one of the great moments of cinema, where an urn is brought up from the ocean. Someone looks at it with contempt and drops it, and it smashes. And so I think prose writing that investigates that relationship between time, subjectivity, and human meaning in order to retrieve something precious and hold on to it seems to me what those Italian novels are doing. So I've recently reread all of Shirley's work because I'm speaking at the seminar tomorrow. And I found the Italian novels surprising. It's been a long time since I've read them. I found surprising the integrity of their vision, that the past is still with us, the past never goes, and that somehow we have to come to terms not just with some simplified old world, new world division, but with the past that carries death, represented symbolically, and this sounds a little reductive, but by Pompeii, I think.
Gail brings us back to Bay of Noon and that amazing opening with the lost plane. And then the wreck of the plane is discovered on the flanks of Vesuvius, snow cone. And I love it in when the narrator in the novel says, no one had expected the wreck to be discovered so close to home. And I've always thought that that was, in many ways, the kind of symbolic phrase which could describe all of her work. Shirley Hazzard casts her narratives far and wide, but in many ways, the wreck is always close to home. And I think, and this is not as far as you would imagine from the initial question that John Galassi raised, I think this Henry Jamesian theme is both there, and I think it's the obvious place to begin thinking about Hazard's work. But I would note, I would actually want to trouble that for a moment, because I think it's actually, I know she has herself said she never really read Henry James until she had written her first novel, and she always has resisted that. I remember her saying once that She didn't really like Henry James that once. She compared his prose to a needle digging into an old gramophone and stuck in the groove and wishing it could be pushed on. And there is the sense that the Henry James international theme, the confrontation of the naive American, say, with the old world, is vastly troubled by her work and complicated. And I was in Naples last summer, I remember, and I was about to head out to Capri for a week. And a Neapolitan friend of mine looked out to Capri. We were looking at it, and I said, I'm heading out there for a week. And he said to me, "Ah, Capri, gli stranieri." And there is the sense that Capri is the stranieri, right? The strangers are out there. And these two worlds are held in very precarious balance. I mean, Naples is a world of, Gioconda, all these old families who are very much, crime and punishment every day. And Capri is a world where, for generations, Germans especially, but, Swedish in particular, the English, Norman Douglas, Americans have, and the English, of course, have come and gone, and the striations in the land, in the cultural landscape are so vivid, and it's a palimpsest as well, right? With endless texts overwritten, going back to Tiberius, who was, of course, the great Roman come out there. So I think in many ways that palimpsest of Capri in some ways might be a more appropriate metaphor I think you've always got Vesuvius, the looming distant volcano, and you've got the rooted civilization of Naples in her work. But I think she's in many ways the resident of Capri, and she's living in, she's adding to this palimpsest, and she's writing and erasing. And I think that her work has these endless cultural layers, and that strikes me as being a further turn of the screw as far as Henry James is concerned. I think it's a difference.
I think listening to this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That we're waiting for something terrible to happen. Mm-hmm. And we do have an idea of what it might be like, but maybe we are pleasing ourselves with that because it might be much more terrifying. And I don't want to say this to be doom-laden, but the world is not thinking, if it ever was, but it's not thinking of itself as something going on forever, our world. Our so-called civilized world, the world we live in, I think that there is now a feeling of some terrible, a culmination that's happening, and
yes.
We aren't handling this in any, I don't mean we outside absolutely reject that feeling, but people who are sensitive to this aren't grappling with it, but sort of feeling that they just, it's always become impossible to contest these things. I hope I'm wrong about the doom part of this, but I think living in Naples, those ancient places, it does give you a feeling of a world that has gone on with its errors and its triumphs and its art and its disasters, a world that's gone on like this. But there was some price to pay, ultimately. And I'm sorry to talk like this, but I think that we haven't dealt with this. And I don't mean me, and I don't mean you, but human beings have been living more in the immediate life and living in consumerism, and of course a lot of people are scientists, they take much greater interest. But we are prepared for what is the unknown for our coming world?
Well, in the Great Fire, you in a sense give us a foreshadowing of everything. I mean, you begin in the wake of the atomic bomb dropping on Hiroshima, and so it's in many ways the recent apocalypse, but the coming apocalypse. and just Vesuvius looms in all your work as a kind of...
We have so much beauty that human beings have created in our world, our literature, our art, all these things that many people don't participate in, but they would not have the life they have unless such things did exist in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's a... I feel there's a kind of suspension. So what comes next? That we know that this is leading to a world which I hope may be better, but which we don't understand what's happening now.
Yes. Well, there's a feeling of fiddling while Rome burns in all of your work. Yeah.
I think it's time to ask anyone in the audience who'd like to make a comment or ask a question to speak.
The question was, what effect did Francis have on your work? Is that right? Sorry? If any.
My husband had the effect we had a very close relation, very close marriage, and very close in our feelings. We didn't have anything to squabble about, and that left no gap in our relationship. And he was a great deal older, a good amount older than I, but we were united in the things that touched us deeply in literature and in all kinds of human sensitivity, which he was very alert to things that we talked about and was very conscious that the world was, how should I say, the world that we lived in was a very privileged world, which I still feel how lucky most of us, and probably all of us here, have been. Whatever goes wrong, we're living in a privileged state of affairs, but it's not privileged in an idiotic sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's privileged in trying to learn where we are, what we are, and learn about other people and what has happened in other centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that I cling to rather that this kind of a prosperity which is relative, let's say, for many people. But I think more people can be interested in what's gone before, what they are trying to do. There's more curiosity in the world than there could have been in other centuries, where there wasn't the ability to study things and to meditate on what had been.
Mm-hmm.
And that might rescue us a bit from some of the other things that are going on.
Good.
So anybody else have? We have time for one more comment or question. Sir.
I'm going to ask a dumb question because I've always been impressed by the ability of the scholars to respond to my dumb questions with extremely insightful answers, and here's your chance. I'd like to know if anyone sees an other than apocalyptic connection between the plane crash in Bay of Noon and the plane crash in the Transit of Venus.
Or the plane crash in the Great Fire. That's another, they connect. Yes. Gail, will you say something?
I think the plane crashes are indeed linked. I think this is a trope. It's a persistent metaphor. And I think the interesting thing about the Great Fire is that Leith is not on the plane that crashes. So there are always things going wrong in the world. There's always this sense of the precariousness of what we have and of those we love. And what is moving in The Great Fire is that the moment when his friend realizes that Leith was not on the plane that crashed. So there is this sense of, I mean, I don't like the word apocalypse. I think that's a rather troubling word. There is a sense of the omnipresence of death in Shirley Hazzard's work, but there are also things and people who are saved. And that I find that very moving, that she considers the drowned and the saved, the crashed and the... I don't have a scholarly answer to your question, I'm sorry. That's
so relieved.
Well, it's now my job to thank everyone for coming tonight, and of course thank our panel and Jonathan for doing a wonderful job hosting, and Annabelle for beautiful, beautiful reading. It's also my job to sell some books. So please do go outside. The Corner Bookstore is here, our friends from the Corner Bookstore, and they're happy to sell you a copy of a number of books so you don't have to go home without some reading tonight. And if I could encourage you to do one thing, it would be to go home and take one of Shirley's books off your shelf and start it tomorrow. So thank you all for coming, and on behalf of the Society Library, have a good evening.